If you enjoy Astronomy FM Radio, please let us know with a small donation. We do rely on your support, and it's true. Every little bit counts.
AFM. You're listening to AFM Radio on astronomy.fm, around the world and beyond.
Arr. Coming up next, it's time for an AFM Radio original program, Space Pirate Radio, brought to you by the Voice of Astronomy MIDI. This is astronomy.fm.
The pirates are coming. The pirates are coming. The pirates are coming. You better watch out.
It's Space Pirate Radio times. Bucko's here on Astronomy.fm Radio, so that would mean it's another Wednesday evening. This one happens to be May 3rd, 2017, at about a minute past 9 o'clock in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America. Universally speaking, though, it is May the 4th be with you. No, that's not a bug. That's not a pirate thing. May the 4th be with you. I can't do my Spock hands either. That's different. That's a different venue. Ah, yes. May the 4th be with you. May the 4th, Thursday morning, 1 o'clock in the morning, Universal Time. So, of course, that means we have our live presentation of Space Pirate Radio going on right now. And invite you to join the crew of our space pirate ship, the Argo. So come on over, everybody. Join the chat room, astronomy.fm/chat, or go to the homepage, astronomy.fm. Get to there, get to the login page, type in a name, and you'll be here. Ask us questions. Do that. I have a question. Optronics has a question. All right, let's go for it. Got questions starting right off the bat.
Indeed.
I know you were out. You tried the question and answer thing at one of the last meetings I was at. Ask a stupid question.
Yes.
But I noticed you didn't quite phrase it right. You don't want to say, "Does anybody have a stupid question that chases people away?" So what you want to qualify it as is like this segment's called "Ask a Stupid Question." The only stupid question is the one that you don't ask. So if anybody has a astronomy-related question, any question, it won't be too considered stupid. We won't embarrass you, but go ahead and ask that question, and we could do that here tonight, too.
Point taken. We actually had a pretty lively stupid question session on Monday. It went well.
Cool.
Yeah.
Optronic says, is the Space Pirate Space Galleon look like the Firefly spaceship? No, it looks more like a traditional three-master.
It has a sail, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, we've got image of it on the official Space Pirates t-shirts that we made last year.
Ooh. And there's one up on our logo somewhere, too. I think in our Facebook page.
And our advertisements, too, in the newsletter.
Yeah, we have a
newsletter. Yep.
Space Pirate Radio Facebook page everybody can go to. It's spacepirateradio-astronomy.fm. Please join that. We'll post messages there before the show, especially if we know that there will be a show or will not be a show for technical reasons or stuff like that. So we'll always post it there at least just a little bit early before the show. It's a good place to check in, and you can see our ship floating above the Earth. All right, let's go. Say hi to everybody in our chat. We consider part of our crew. We got you and me, of course. We got Glenn, Plaid Joan, Optronics, Black Project, Plaid Sister, Evil Spock, Plaid Mech, and Twist Edge. Welcome aboard, everybody. Let's sail or do a little sailing around the universe, or maybe around the solar system too. How about that? All that cool stuff out there. A little bit of solar stuff. Yeah, very little solar stuff. One small sunspot group on the sun. It is a group, though. It's not one spot, so it is a group. It's 2.5 spots of active region 2654. Not much is happening with it, though. Solar winds are way down. Particle density is way down. Solar winds are 344 kilometers per second. That's pretty slow. And density of 2.45 protons per cubic centimeter. That's just a little bit of a dusting.
Sun looks a little more interesting in different wavelengths, but in straight up white light, no.
Yeah, that one active region is kind of a little bit of a hot spot, but not too much. A coronal hole near the south portion of the sun.
Yep, we had that big coronal hole in the north portion for a long time, and this one's in the south.
Mm-hmm. But neither one is kicking out much towards us, so can't really expect any fun stuff flying at us. Oh, well, still got some activity, but nothing great. How about we go through what's up in the sky a little bit?
Well, I haven't seen the sky in weeks, Marty.
Oh, but it's been clear.
It's clear tonight. It is beautiful. Clear tonight.
It's been, yeah, a few other nights, too. Been nice. Moon should be out there, being about first quarter, real close to it. In fact, it is first quarter moon tonight, so, and officially in about another hour, so we're pretty close to that. Let's see. Thursday, May the 4th, 10 hours universal time, Regulus, 0.5 degrees north of the moon. There will be an occultation. And this one I was able to look up early. Best place to see this is if you are in the eastern portion of Australia.
Ooh.
Hey, Rob Black, go out and check out the moon a little bit past first quarter. And going to cover up Regulus.
Nice.
Sometime pretty soon. Another 8 hours or so. Sunday, Mars will be north of 6 degrees north of Aldebaran. Also on Sunday, Jupiter will be 2 degrees south of the moon. Sunday, Mercury is 2 degrees south of Uranus. Oh, a lot of stuff all over there. And Monday, Juno stationary. And I did look this one up. Juno is in the constellation of Aquila the Eagle. And it's like about, 10 degrees east of M11, the Wild Duck star cluster.
Yes, that is a very pretty object.
Mm-hmm. And you get out some regular observing stuff again. Got to find a little closer observing site to where I live, where I can just get out in the country a little bit without having to go up to our observatory.
You live a heck of a lot closer to it than I do.
Yeah, that's
true. We're probably about as far to the west of it, but I'm considerably to the south.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I understand.
No, it's just hard to get there. Yeah.
No. It's not getting there, Marty. It's coming back after a full night of observing.
Well, that too.
There's been quite a few nights of, white knuckles, emergency driver handoffs, lots of coffee.
Head out the window, whatever works to keep
you tight. Some of that.
Type of stuff. You know, it's kind of tough doing that, so... The club did have its open house a few weeks ago, I think it was.
I heard the open house was great. Now, I was planning to go up there for Astronomy Day, and Astronomy Day was lousy.
Yeah, it was all rainy and
clouds, rain, chilly. Yeah, no good.
Yep. But the open house night, that was the night we saw two comets.
Yeah, you finally saw 41P using the club's 22-inch reflector, which is awesome. And you saw, what was the other one, Comet Johnson?
Johnson, yep.
Nice.
Which is still flying across the north skies pretty well in Hercules area, so reasonably bright. That's the one that's kicking out all the good comet photographs lately. So not really big comet stuff, but kind of a two short tails, one gas tail and one dust tail. And they do look kind of nice. They're not like a great, great comet, but not too bad, and photographically it's doing okay.
A comet for amateur astronomers to appreciate, in other words. Not going to excite the general public, but you know what? It's been a while since we had any kind of decent comet in the northern hemisphere.
I know, and even one for amateur astronomers, we'll take that. And if we get to get some of the general public to come to our observatory, then they can get a look at it too, and they actually do see it.
That's cool. Yeah, when I took a poll at the Astronomy Club meeting the other night, you were the only person who had managed to see 41P, so props to you.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that bad. It took a little work because it was circumpolar, so it kind of had to get above the northeastern horizon out of the garbage. And then, because when I first looked for it, I couldn't see it. But then after a while, I was able to actually pick it out. And we picked it out in like a 9-inch telescope also a little bit later. So it wasn't impossibly dark.
Cool.
Let's see, a little AAVSO project, alert notice 575, monitoring of designated object Swift J113-57, whatever, you can look it up yourself, for a Dr. Gregory Siakov of the University of Alberta requested AAVSO observers observing this object. Let me put the link into our chat room here. It's kind of an interesting object. Let's see, where's our chat room? There we go. Check this out. It's a black hole binary system. That's an outburst. Now, it's an outburst, but that does not mean you're going to be able to see it. It's a few degrees brighter than, I think, its normal visual magnitude of 22. Not a few degrees, but a few magnitudes
22
brighter.
22 is pretty faint.
Yeah, so it gets up to like 17, 18, something like that. So
I have an old astronomy book from the late 1970s. So as far as I'm concerned, it's old because it predates me. It mentioned 20th magnitude as being Palomar limit at the time. So yeah, 22 magnitude, that's pretty... I don't think I'm going to be chasing that one.
No, but you know, good-sized telescope with a CT camera and stuff like that.
That's the trick, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well outside the optical range of visual observing of anything I've got in my arsenal.
Yeah, that's what they're saying on this one, though. So, but there are amateurs that have access to some pretty big telescopes.
There are amateurs with some pretty sweet stuff, true.
Yeah, with their own telescopes, yeah. And, and other
equipment, too. They're all good with a 36-inch mountaintop in the Arizona desert.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And some decent-sized cameras, and they know how to use them. So it is possible. Obviously, there's more amateur telescopes out that can do this than professional telescopes, so... again, another citizen science project where you'll be able to help do some observation. Now, the dipping on this one is actually interesting. It can actually dip really quick. Its source is known to undergo recurring rapid dips. These dips can last for tens of seconds and occur on timescales of a few minutes. So this one can actually brighten up or dim down fairly rapidly. So that's what they want. Some observations of. So basically, you don't have to do like one a year observation. They want as many as you can get, basically. Especially since it seems to be having some outburst right now. So check it out. And as I always say, even though you can't see it, see if you can actually find where this object is in the sky and put your telescope there and see if you can find like the star pattern that you would be able to pick out in your eyepiece and you know what, I'm looking right at this object, even though I don't see it, but I can identify the star pattern in this field of view, and I know that that's where it should be at. This one, by the way, 13 hours, 57 minutes, right ascension, minus 9 hours, 32 minutes. It's actually Virgo, about 9 degrees east of Spica.
Cool.
Give you an idea where it's at. Like I said, when you go out and do some general observing, at least see if you can point your telescope in that spot. Even if you don't even have a camera, that can go find it. So you can find this alert notice at the American Association of Variable Star Observers. And more projects, too. A lot of ongoing projects that they have like this one. So, seen any Saturn videos lately?
No. Now, of course, the reason we would care, I did see one. A very short one, black and white. I was shown it by a colleague on Monday. So the reason that we're talking about Saturn videos is, of course, the death dive of Cassini.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see what we've got here. Cassini's got some work to do on the way down.
Mm-hmm. So interesting images of the planet, and most recently discovered there is very little debris between the rings and the planet.
Yep. Nice and clean.
Mm-hmm. I guess when Cassini went like outside the rings, it picked up a lot of particles. And this, you know, like had a lot of, like hundreds of hits. So this time when they went on the inside of the rings, they thought they were going to get just as many or more. And turned out they got less. They got like a handful of hits, of particle hits. So the gap between Saturn and its rings is actually rather void of particles. Kind of a safe spot to fly through. I think this is the first flyover out of about 21, something like that. 21 major orbits for Cassini. And then that's about it.
Yeah, and actually, I like how the LA Times covered it. Here's the nothingness Cassini heard. Not just imaged, heard.
Yes. They had, they had the big antenna out, I think, to block particles, but they had some other smaller antennas out there, too, and it could actually detect particle hits. hardly any at all. So that's kind of good. So they could do some more work, but they don't have to have the big antenna blocking the spacecraft.
Yeah, the big, they're using the big antenna as a shield.
Yeah. So they don't have to do that. So they can actually do some real scientific research when it's flying between the rings and Saturn without having to worry about it being damaged. So they can change attitudes on it now.
Now, computer models had suggested that the zone between Saturn and the rings would be dust-free, but models had demonstrated, you know, it hadn't been completely accurate before. And other times that Cassini was going through the ring planet, they thought, okay, no dust. Well, there was dust. But in this case, no, it's pretty darn clean.
Yep.
And the particles themselves, because Cassini could be damaged by something the size of a grain of sand, are smaller than the particles in cigarette smoke.
Yes. So if they hit something, it wouldn't be any bad. Like scuff some of the paint, that might be it.
Yeah.
But not even enough particles to do that. Let's see. Got a couple of articles from NASA, one by Sophia, that confirmed a nearby planetary system that is quite similar to the Earth's and the Sun in its early formation days. The system is located 10.5 light years away in the constellation of Eridanus. What was the tie into this? I was going to say, yeah, this is the Babylon 5 space station.
Okay.
Yep, this is the star system Epsilon Eridani.
Gotcha. Okay.
So interesting, they had that space station in a star system that actually is kind of similar to our star system, as far as like rocky particles and ice particles and stuff like that, and gaps in the systems and stuff like that. So kind of interesting. Let me put that article into our chat room again if anybody wants to read further on this. And you could also go to our Facebook page, and we'll put the links to those articles in our Facebook page. Again, do some more in-depth reading.
Cool. And Sophia is, of course, quite an interesting mission by itself.
Yep. SOFIA stands for Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy.
So how do you have a telescope in the stratosphere, Marty?
You fly it.
Yeah. Up and then down again.
In an airplane.
Yep.
So it's a infrared telescope. Basically not picking up visible light, picks up infrared light, which not all the infrared light likes to come down to the surface of the Earth. So the higher up you can get the infrared detector, the more infrared light you can actually pick up. So that's, you could do a spaceship. What's a space probe satellite that does infrared? Is it Chandra? No, that's X-rays.
That's right. You're thinking of Spitzer?
Spitzer, yes. So you could either do it out in space or low Earth orbit, where you can access your equipment a little bit easier. Now, really low Earth orbit would just be, flying as high in the atmosphere as you can get. Get your data that way.
So SOFIA is a modified 747 that carries a 100-inch telescope. So that's a pretty cool setup.
Yeah, eight inch mirror. That's pretty good. I could use one of those. Now, if I can just
Where would you put it?
I don't know if there's enough runway room to get it to land at our observatory region.
Well, we could put it somewhere. I don't know where we'd put up the tube that you'd need for a mirror of that size.
I think and just leave it in the plane.
Okay.
It's got to be short focal length to fit basically inside the plane, right?
Okay.
So just leave it in the plane, park the whole plane there. Maybe we can get when they get rid of all science in the U.S., they'll probably auction that plane off for $100. If you know, the right person, the right time, we could just submit a bid and tow that thing onto the observatory grounds and use it right inside the airplane there.
I'm not really sure we have room to park a 747.
Well, we could take the wings off. We can sell them for scrap metal. That'll pay for like the stairs to get up into it. Or we could just partly cut one of the wings off. It'll tilt down, and we use it as a stairway to get up into the plane. How's that sound?
I'd love my own 747.
Planning ahead here, yes. But
a 747 with a telescope is even better. Yeah, good luck finding anybody to pilot one of those.
Well, a lot of people that would pilot one.
A lot of people that would, but not that many people qualified to do so.
Yeah. I don't know. Friends of mine, an airline pilot, and if we paid him his regular income, he'd be more than happy to fly 747 around. A lot of people would.
So we do a Kickstarter to get the money to pay the pilot for the plane with the 100-inch telescope that we're going to hypothetically buy off the U.S. government.
Right, after they get rid of all science.
Maybe we should stick to the salvage jobs in space, Marty.
I think so, too. Well, I was speaking for the Astronomy Club, not for space pirates. Space pirates have to get an orbiting satellite telescope. So let's see, what are they going to decommission? Maybe the Hubble? If they decommission the Hubble, they wouldn't bring it down. They would just leave it there. We could snag that and pop it into our pirate ship.
Yeah, it's only the size of a school bus. It'll fit.
No problem. Have you seen the North Pole of Enceladus?
No, actually. I've looked at lots of the pretty Saturnian moon pictures coming back, but why don't you share this North Pole picture?
All right, let me get it here. Mm-hmm, come on, NASA. NASA's image of the day. And I click on it and it doesn't go anywhere. All right, let me put that into our chat room. Here we go. Lots of craters. Of course, this is a moon of Saturn?
Yes.
Enceladus. Okay. So probably taken with Cassini, I'm thinking.
I would assume.
Because it would be...
Anything older than Cassini is probably Voyager 1.
Well, I'm thinking what would be flying over the North Pole of Saturn and be able to get the North Pole of Enceladus. So Cassini, lots of craters and streaks and some swirly stuff and shallow, very shallow craters, though. So there it is in our chat room. Good reason to come over into the chat room, because if we post some pictures that we find out there, you can click on them and take a look at yourself while we're talking about it.
Yeah, that's a cool image.
Mm-hmm. And I forgot to check our chat room for any more questions.
I mean, part of why it's notable is that Enceladus being this active moon that has these geysers, there are parts of it that are not pockmarked in craters.
Mm-hmm.
But the North Pole clearly is. As the caption says, the surface in the north appears to be as old as any in the solar system, something that's been heavily bombarded in every surface, like, say, Callisto, whereas the south has been remade. Younger, fresher.
Because of all the eruptions?
Yeah. All the activity.
So, did I mention this before? So, all we really have to do is don't have to actually bore into Enceladus to find out if there's organic material in the water. All you have to do is land on the surface where it has been recently outflowing and be able to analyze the water that way. So, that's much more doable. I mean, if the stuff is erupting, hopefully there's, good amount of churning from the bottom towards the surface. And if it comes up through fissures in the ice, and that's the spot you have to be, and just dip a spoon in there and taste it. Don't have to go that far down in.
Taste it. With machines, of course.
That's right.
Let's not actually taste it.
Mm-hmm. I don't see any launches scheduled recently. Let's see, coming up tomorrow, there will be a lecture from NASA JPL and Cassini Science Highlights and the Grand Finale. So check that out tomorrow at 10 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time.
Cool.
The NASA channel. So you can just simply go to the NASA website, and then you'll see where it's highlighted, and you could convert it to your time, too. Let's see. One last article from Chandra X-ray Observatory. about the Perseus Galaxy Cluster. I remember that much about this. Is a cluster of galaxies in Perseus that is about, I think, 250 million light years away from us, 240 million light years away. And the galaxy is kind of, the galaxy cluster is kind of filled with some pretty hot gas, averaging tens of millions of degrees. And they've kind of found this swirling pattern through it, and a bit of an indentation in the swirling pattern. So they think this is swirling pattern is just gases being churned up and heated up, sort of heated up by magnetic fields. And the indentation in the swirling pattern is probably from a nearby galaxy cluster. It's kind of passed by it. So I didn't know galaxy clusters had that much gas between them and stuff like that. So I guess so. Perseus constellation in the northern hemisphere.
Yeah, generally a sort of a October, November, December kind of constellation.
Yeah, I don't recall if I've ever actually looked at any of the galaxies in that cluster.
I haven't.
I don't recall if there's any bright enough for us to see. 250 million light years is a bit far. Now, the
you don't say.
Yeah. Well, the Virgo cluster, that's about 60 million light years away. And this galaxy is about brightest one's eighth magnitude, something like that. So fairly easy to see through almost any size telescope.
You can pick up. And pick out Virgo and binoculars. Yeah.
Yeah, it's actually pretty easy to see those smudges. So let's see. Four times farther away would make it eight times dimmer or 16 times dimmer.
It's cubic, isn't it?
Yeah. Inverse square law.
Yeah. Okay.
Double the distance, a quarter of the away. So what would that be, about 12th magnitude stars, something like that?
I'm not picking these up in my binoculars.
No, I don't think so. But so 12 magnitude galaxies are definitely doable in a 10-inch telescope or so. So to see if there's some brighter ones there. I have to look up this cluster and see if I can, if I've actually seen any of those sometime and check it out. A few more minutes to halfway point. Got something for just before our halfway point?
Well, I picked up some stories this week, but they're more a bit towards cosmology, and I don't know, perhaps some of you have seen the dark matter, maybe fuzzier than we thought. Like, well, it's fuzzy enough, we don't know what it is, but, latest findings coming out of the Chandra X-ray Observatory that, finds out that the properties of dark matter are not quite what we think. Or what many of us think. So,
does it matter?
Honestly, at this point, we need more data.
I think so too. Here's a little bit more data, though. They think the gamma ray glow at the center of the Milky Way is possibly not caused by dark matter, but more likely caused by pulsars.
Oh, that, yes, actually, that was a story I was going to have after the break. A hidden population of pulsars that may be, as you said, brightening up the Milky Way. And so, if it would be a far more mundane explanation than, dark matter is doing it.
So, maybe dark matter is getting darker. It's some of it's becoming other stuff.
Yeah, no, that's actually these kind of things are come as a bit of a relief to me personally if there turns out to be a mundane explanation for any of these phenomena that we currently attribute to dark matter.
And dark energy too.
Yeah, of course, dark energy and dark matter are two different beasts that just happen to have completely confusing names.
Means that we can't see them like we normally see stuff in the universe, either through visible light from like stars or from the heat from the objects, infrared, which will actually penetrate dust. So if there's like a lot of dust getting in the way of something that we can actually penetrate the dust with infrared telescopes. Then there's radio waves, which will go through dust. X-rays, gamma rays that we can actually detect. So if we can't see it in visible light, we can pick them up with things with X-rays or gamma rays. So what if there's something out there that we see an effect of, but can't detect it in any of those wavelengths? What could it be is the big question. So we can tell that dark matter seems to affect, not galaxies, but it seems to add more gravity to galaxies, indicating that there's much more material in a galaxy than we can actually detect with those instruments. And we can tell that effect by, for instance, a fairly massive galaxy that bends the light of a galaxy behind it. And you can kind of, and if we get something like a supernova in the galaxy behind it and measure how far away, using a supernova to determine how far away it is, then we can kind of determine how much mass would have to be in the galaxy that's causing the lens effect, because it has to have so much material in it to make so much gravity to bend that light and that shape. And looking at all the material that's in the galaxy, we can't detect enough of it. So we know the gravity is there, and the gravity basically is associated with mass. So the more gravity is, that must mean there's more stuff in it. We can't see the stuff. So what could be in this galaxy that is a bunch of stuff that we can't actually detect? And that's the big thing about dark matter. Dark energy is the kind of a different thing. When we see the farther back we look in the universe, the farther away a galaxy is, but they've got to be kind of pretty far away, the faster they move away from us. So by doing the math, again, of how much stuff should be in the Milky Way galaxy, how much energy it took for the original Big Bang, kept doing all those formulas, measuring the galaxies, measuring their distances, they seem to be moving apart faster than the math says. So again, kind of using all the detecting equipment that we can, saying there's so much stuff in the universe, or the Big Bang was so this level of explosive, but things are flying away like the explosion was bigger. But we can't actually measure that, anything that says that explosion was bigger, but stuff's moving faster like it had an extra big kick. So it's like something is pushing the galaxies away farther than
and
just normal.
And we call it dark energy, because now we don't know.
That's right.
You can basically put air quotes around dark energy and it's a mystery.
Mm-hmm. So kind of like you film a firecracker going off, but it knocks down buildings like an atomic bomb.
Yeah. I like that image.
That's kind of dark energy. It's like, well, this is kind of small. How did, give us such a big push like that? So, to figure out why.
Well, it's pushed us well past the bottom of the hour.
It has. So that means we are at our halfway point here at 9:33 p.m. in the evening, Wednesday, May the 3rd, 2017, for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America. And, of course, Universal Time, it is May the 4th be with you, 1:34 in the morning, Thursday morning, May the 4th, 2017. It's Universal Time. So that means we still have about half our program to go through live yet. So if you're listening in, stick around. Another 25 minutes of live programming. And, of course, our usual lineup of programming afterwards, including Astronomy Ireland, Planetary Radio, Planetary Radio, Naked Scientists, Naked Astronomy, all coming up after Space Pirate Radio. And, of course, we want to say hi to everybody that's in our chat room right now. We've got you and me. We've got Glenn, Plaid, Joan, Optronics, Black Project, Sister Plaid, Plaid Mac, Twist Edge, Aquafew, and Dave H. All welcome. We consider you part of our crew when you join us here at Space Pirate Radio in the chat room. And everybody can come on in the chat room. If you got a question for us, come on over and ask it. And we'll try to answer your question on air as best we can if we can see it. You can get here by going to our homepage, astronomy.fm, and you see where it says radio chat, or type in astronomy.fm/chat, and you'll either way you'll get to the login page. So type in a name, a handle, whatever you want, hit login, and you'll be here. It's easy, and we don't control your computer after you do that, so it's not so bad. Let's see. Yeah, we got other people that put in articles, too, in the chat room, so if you want to do some further reading.
Actually, I did like the one that John, a.k.a. Twisted, shared about the shape of the heliosphere. So we had some ideas about what the heliosphere looked like.
Mm-hmm.
And in between Voyager data and Cassini data, you're thinking our artist renderings are not correct. So instead of looking like a tadpole in space with a tail, you're more like a bubble. Mm-hmm. Nice symmetrical bubble around us.
Heliosphere is basically particles coming from the sun that spread out in every direction from the sun. And they just basically keep on going until they run into other things that kind of make a, you know, hold it back a little bit.
It's like the literal outer fringes of the solar system.
Yeah, so basically like particles from other stars, cosmic rays, things like that are all traveling through the galaxy. And they, you know, the ones that head towards our solar system will kind of hit the particles from the sun heading out, and they'll kind of slow them down. They'll kind of create a little bit of a boundary layer called the heliopause, and they're trying to figure out what the shape of the heliosphere actually is. So if there's, for instance, if a bunch more particles coming from one direction than the other direction, that would mean more particles will bunch up on one side of the sun and not on the other side. So they thought, well, maybe there was just like only bunched up stuff on one part of the sphere and almost nothing on the other part of the sphere, so the particles would actually slip through on the other side, But you said this article says, no, it looks like we're kind of getting bombarded equally from all directions.
Yeah, I've got some NASA posters that I need to burn now for rather than use them for outreach purposes that show the tadpole heliosphere.
Uh-huh. On a local scale, the same thing kind of happens with the Earth itself. So particles coming from the sun hit our magnetic field, and they kind of bunch up between the Earth and the sun. We're real close to the sun. And then behind the Earth, the opposite direction from the sun, particles kind of stray off. We kind of got a bit of a tail. So they thought, well, maybe that was the same shape for the entire solar system. But turns out not with the latest data, which could change. More satellites we had out there, we might be able to find some other shapes. There could be really lumpy shapes. You never know. Let's see. Where was I going to go with?
Let's see. We covered pulsars, we covered the dark matter, and what the last thing that I've got queued up, cosmology-wise, is the cosmic cold spot.
Cosmic cold spot?
Yeah.
I'm not too familiar with that cosmic.
Well, you are familiar with the cosmic microwave background image.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
The quote-unquote fingerprint of the Big Bang, you know, very famous oval map of, you know, red spots and blue spots. Well, there's a particular map of the CMB that was taken with the Planck satellite. And there's a actual down on the lower right-hand margin of this elliptical map. There's a blue spot. It's very, very cold there. Now, one reason that it might be very, very cold there is, and we're talking, okay, the background radiation is 2.73 degrees above absolute zero. This area is 0.00015 degrees below that. It's cold.
It's all relative.
It's relative, yeah.
But
it's
relatively speaking, it's cold.
Relatively,
yes.
You would not notice because you would already be very, very, very dead if you were experiencing these differences in temperature.
Yes.
So, simple explanation would be there's nothing there. Lack of matter, right? It's cold because there's no material. Oh, apparently not. So once you rule out the nice, elegant, mundane, non-controversial possibility, nothing there, you go for more exotic explanations. And you know how problematic things can get when you start having to go for the exotic, right, Marty?
Mm-hmm.
You don't necessarily like that in science. Simplicity, elegance, Occam's razor and all that sort of thing. Well, we can't apply Occam's razor to this, apparently.
Let's see. We got a comment here from Aquafew. Let's see. Something says bunches about the shape of magnetic reconnection events in Earth's magnetotail. There you go. There is no magnetotail on the outside of the envelope. Yeah, it could be. I haven't read up on it in a while. The shape of the Earth's magnetosphere, basically. Yeah, there's definitely reconnection events behind the Earth, which actually tend to snap and you know, we get more particles in our atmosphere from that, too. So more aurora caused by reconnecting magnetic field lines behind the Earth. Welcome, Perry P. in our chat room. Just joined
us
in.
And Richie. Yep. Two people joined last couple minutes.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, I will not say that the latest information on the shape of the Earth's magnetic field in any way, shape, or form, because I have not been up to date on it. That's fine. Somebody, was it Black Projects? Or I can't remember who put it into our chat room. No, sorry, not into our chat room, but in a Facebook post. And I thought, oh, this is kind of cool. Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter something or other. Anyway, the picture of Tycho's limb. It's amazing. Let me put this into our chat room here. Tycho on the Moon. Super close-up video. Super close-up image of the central mountain in the crater Tycho. And look at the detail in this picture. This is a view of the eastern side of Tycho's central peak. The sun, on this image, the sun was relatively high above the horizon. And I haven't gone through these images quite a bit, but I think I need to start going through some of these images. And this one of Tycho's. Now, Tycho's a really big crater. I can't remember what the diameter of it, but it has a central mountain peak in it. And this is just part of the central mountain peak inside this crater. And Tycho, I think, is one in the southern part of the southern central
huge,
region of the moon.
Huge rays.
Yeah.
Bright rays.
Mm-hmm. Where when that large rock hit that part, it blew a bunch of dust particles in kind of like lines laying out in all directions. So they kind of like, kind of point towards the central part, sort of. Real prominent crater, the neck of the Lady of the Moon. So check out this image. I haven't been to LRO images in a long time. There's some pretty cool stuff. Oh, they've got a 3D one, green and blue. And I just happened to have gotten my 3D glasses out of the drawer. So I'm going to have to check this one out. So if you got some red and green or red and blue 3D glasses, check out these images. Where's this one? Maunder's Central Peak. Interesting. Another one I've been checking out lately, too, is Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter images. They got some pretty cool stuff there. Where did I lose my NASA tab? Always releasing new images from Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, some detailed stuff, some pretty close-up stuff. So you want to see some nice close-up images of the surface of Mars from orbit. Check out the MRO missions on the NASA website. And there's actually some really cool stuff. A lot of different types of dirt. And what were they? Some kind of like beach sand, but it's not white. It's actually kind of a grayish color, which they say was from iron and magnesium. Now, I wonder if that would be like unoxidized iron being so black. What color is magnesium? Are they kind of chemically reacting together? I didn't read any more information.
I haven't had the chance to play with any raw magnesium in a while, Marty.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. I'll just think of your magnesium rims on your sports car. They get kind of corroded. I guess they kind of get dark. Maybe that makes sense. I don't know.
Yeah, my main use of magnesium was, the whole explosion thing.
Exploding magnesium?
Yeah.
We used to burn it. We never exploded it.
Well, depends on water. Water and fire, man.
You light it on fire and then drop it in water?
No, you sprinkle it with water. Well, it's already burning, and then you've got it burning, and then you add water, and boom.
Oh, because it's so high heat when it's burning that it probably vaporizes the water very quickly, and is that what does it? Or is it a chemical reaction type of thing?
I think I would have to check. It's been years since I did chemistry, but I thought it was a chemical property.
Well, I know, isn't something else like that? Is it phosphorus?
It's a solid magnesium plus the oxygen turns into magnesium hydroxide and hydrogen gas. Hydrogen gas is flammable, Hindenburg, so you get a nice mess.
All I remember is having a small coil of magnesium strips, like 3 to 6 inches long or something like that, and you'd light it, and it would burn with this really super bright, intense light, kind of like a welding arc that you actually couldn't look at it because the UV coming off it would start to fog up your eyes.
Ew. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, my favorite color of magnesium is on fire.
Okay. None of that dark magnesium metal-y stuff oxidized. Well, looking around the skies, Mars is still hanging out there. Just after the sun goes down, yep, Mars is still barely visible. So if you want to get some views of Mars, get them in soon. Looks like it's in about Taurus, the bull, and Taurus is setting early and earlier now. And we're about to lose Orion pretty soon here, too. That's getting in the last bits of twilight. So for the northern hemisphere, considered a winter constellation. So that's good to know that we're actually starting to lose our winter constellations. And then we get into the springtime stuff of, we've still got a little bit of Gemini out there, and then Cancer the Crab and Leo the Lion. And, of course, Leo Virgo gets into the realm of galaxy clusters. So if you like doing galaxy observing, this is the time to do it in the early part of the evening. Lots of galaxies. The moon's just about into Leo tonight, so going to get in the way for the next few or 4 days. So you might want to skip the galaxy hunting for about at least a week till the moon gets past Leo and Virgo. But you got nice Jupiter. And of course, I always advocate observing Jupiter and its moons because they're always changing their positions around. You see shadows of Jupiter's moons go across the front of Jupiter. It'll go into it out of the shadows. In fact, I looked up, I think it was one that was last Friday or something like that. I can't remember what the date was, but I saw one where the moon came out from behind Jupiter, and 3 minutes later, it was entering the shadow of Jupiter.
Huh.
So that'd be kind of an interesting event. So if you didn't actually watch that moon at just the right time, you wouldn't be able to see it at all. So because it would have been behind and only out for a couple minutes and then back into the shadow of Jupiter. So some cool stuff like that you can actually watch in real time instead of I'm going to have to watch this moon for 4 hours and see something change. No, sometimes you can actually see things change in just a couple of minutes with Jupiter and its moons, whether going in front of the planet, behind the planet, in or out of the shadows. And, of course, they're always changing their positions, too. So those moon events you can go to at projectpluto.org, I think it is, and look up Jovian events. And you kind of have to learn how to decipher the events are listed as, the moon's 1, 2, 3, 4 using Roman numerals. And it'll look up, I think, near the top. It'll tell you what each moon is and what the event is. So, for instance, a transit means the moon's going in front of Jupiter. Occultation means the moon's going behind Jupiter. And it'll say start or end. So that means it's just starting to happen or just unhappening, basically. And then there's also a shadow, which means the shadow of the moon is going to go in front of Jupiter. Or an eclipse, which means the moon of Jupiter will actually go into the shadow of Jupiter, or come out of the shadow of Jupiter. What I like to look for on the list are events. Well, for instance, Jupiter has to be up and in my sky. So, for instance, if it's, you know, happening at noon my local time, it's like, I'm not going to see it. That's happening on the opposite side of the world. So first I got to pick out the times that are on my local sky. And then I look for times that are really close together. So you basically kind of just scan down the list, because the right side of the list will be the times. So you look for times that are really close together. And usually you can find a couple of times. Like, say, one event was like at 10:31 and 10:34. That was the moon going from behind Jupiter into its shadow. So that told me right there was something interesting. What's really cool is when there's three events happening at the same time. You can get like a moon coming out from behind Jupiter into its shadow. And then on the opposite side of Jupiter, another moon will be having a different event. So just kind of scan down the list for times that are really close and check the times and see if they're actually going to be visible from where you live.
And if you've got something, a double or a triple event going on, possibly with a double, certainly with a triple, your local astronomy club might well be setting up some kind of observing session for it. If it's visible, during your nighttime.
Mm-hmm. Or get people to go ahead and tell them, look this stuff up.
Yeah.
Create some lists for your local area. I used to do that too. I used to go through these lists and basically I would just copy them my own events that were going to be visible, like when Jupiter had to be above the horizon and in the nighttime sky. And then I would just basically make my own list for our local area and then bring them out to observing sessions. And then I could tell people, hey, something's going to happen with Jupiter at this time, like midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning or something, basically kind of easy to see and make it a little bit interesting. And everybody would get their telescopes out at the same time. Same thing with like the space station flying over. Whenever we have a event at our observatory, somebody is always looking up to see if the space station is going to fly over and alert everybody to that. Or if there was an Iridium satellite that was going to brighten up during our observing time, especially early in the evening, just after it gets dark, and you have some general public out in your observing areas, like it's good to tell them. It's like, okay, look in this direction, up about halfway up at this time, and see if you can spot a satellite getting really bright. And you can tell them what it was. It impresses people when you give them special events like that too. And what else is coming up in the sky? Oh, the Big Dipper for Northern Hemisphere observers is really high up.
That means good hunting for galaxies.
Exactly.
Galaxies are a lot closer than the Perseus cluster.
Yes. So we've got Leo, Virgo, and the Big Dipper region for some galaxies. M81 and M82 for Northern Hemisphere observers. Southern Hemisphere observers, well, you've got stuff like the Large Magellanic Cloud, the Small Magellanic Clouds. Oh, there's some new information about the Small Magellanic Cloud.
Ooh, I missed that. Why don't you share?
Where did I put that article? Let me keep checking. It's here somewhere. It was a new observation. The Small Magellanic Cloud. Here it is. Nope, that's not it.
Marty.
I had it. Then I offed it. What?
I was about to blame you for the link that just got posted, but no, that was John feeding me something.
Was that the same one?
Not unless it's got to do with an ancient stone tablet at a temple in Turkey.
Oh, cool. Okay. End up with a pyramid story, huh? Or something similar. All right, here it comes. Called a VISTA. So let me post that into our chat room first, what VISTA is. VISTA captures record-breaking image of the Small Magellanic Cloud. And VISTA is the Visible and Infrared Survey Telescope that is in Chile, I believe. And because of a lot of dust that's in galaxies. It actually makes it hard to see some of the stars. Like, if you're out at nighttime looking at the band of the Milky Way, you can see kind of like bright patches. Well, the band of the Milky Way is mostly bright, but sometimes you'll see a lot of dark regions. Well, that's actually a lot of dust obscuring the stars behind them. And that's called extinction. So basically, if you try to look at anything more towards the center of our Milky Way galaxy, the things will actually be dimmer because of all the gas that we have to look through to try to see them. And the same thing with other galaxies, too. They have things called extinction. And the Small Magellanic Cloud is one of them. So the best way to see through dust like that is with infrared, picking up basically more of the heat, which can actually penetrate the dust than visible light can. So this is the latest image of the Small Magellanic Cloud. They've done like one of the highest quality images of the Small Magellanic Cloud to see more stars and more stuff inside of it. So check that out. Oh, by the way, the Small Magellanic Cloud, I should say, is actually a companion galaxy to our own Milky Way galaxy. So we're actually part of three galaxies. Our own main Milky Way galaxy, a fairly large spiral-shaped galaxy. It's about 100,000 light years across, something like that. And then at about 150 and about 200,000 light years away from the Milky Way galaxy are two smaller galaxies. One's bigger, called the Large Magellanic Cloud. The smaller one, called the Small Magellanic Cloud, does not have a spiral structure, doesn't have an oval structure. It's just kind of a lump of stars. They're called, irregular shaped galaxies. So it doesn't look like any particular central core in either of these galaxies. Probably disrupted maybe by the Milky Way galaxy itself. So if they had any structure to them, they've kind of been like shredded up by the Milky Way's gravity a little bit. So they're kind of lumpy, but they have some interesting regions. Some of them have some bright star forming regions in them. Some condensations and things like that. So.
Large Magellanic Cloud has some really cool stuff going on in it.
Yeah, like the Tarantula Nebula. Yes. Star-forming region, kind of like the Orion Nebula.
Except huge.
Yes. Now, the Orion Nebula is about 1,500 light years away from us, and it's about the size of the full moon, sort of, to our eyes. Well, if the Tarantula Nebula was at the same distance, it would fill the entire constellation of Orion. That's how much bigger it is. Check this out. The latest and best picture of the Small Magellanic Cloud, companion to the Milky Way. Milky Way actually has a lot of little companions too, called dwarf galaxies. Some of them, not very many stars at all, and kind of barely detectable because so many stars that we have to look through the Milky Way itself before we can actually see the other stars. So they kind of blend in, so they have to do some measurements on the stars and find out how far away they are. So we know if they're well beyond our Milky Way galaxy, then we can measure several of the stars that same distance, that we know it's actually a little cluster. And our Milky Way galaxy tends to shred small clusters. And that's what adds more stars to our Milky Way galaxy. But we're going to get a lot of stars in about a billion years or so. From the Andromeda Galaxy. We'll shred each other and become one big lump of a galaxy. I don't know if anybody's ever come up with a name for the new lumped up elliptical galaxy we'll probably get in a few billion years. Have to come up with something.
They already did.
What do they call it?
Milkomeda.
Milkomeda?
Yeah.
Mm-mm. Yeah, maybe.
I'm not saying it's a good name, I'm saying it's a name.
Oh, let's see. I didn't get John's link here. We only got about a minute left or less.
Yeah, really interesting about how an important geological epoch called the Younger Dryas might have been sparked by a comet impact. Not that they found the impact site, but they found some interesting tablets in a genuine temple in Anatolia. And so, yeah. Hadn't heard of this before, might be worth looking into, but there were some kind of speculative sentences.
We'll put the link into our Facebook page, so check that out.
We'll share it anyway, so y'all can follow along at home.
Well, time for us to get out of here, everybody, so I want to thank everybody in chat. Appreciate it. Don't forget, more programming after Space Pirate Radio, so stay tuned for more stuff. And we're out of here. Good night, everybody.
Clear skies, y'all.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of Astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are Astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is Astronomy.fm Radio.
AFM.